childhood, and before the social pressure of dating. Young girls looked up to her and actually listened, and many became accomplished writers very quickly. It wasn't unusual for some of the girls later to text her and send a direct message to find out how their horse was doing. Sheridan always replied that the horse missed them as much as they missed their horse. Just as there was a rhythm to each week from when new families arrived, unplugged, and settled in, there was a rhythm to the summer for the staff as well, she'd found. The first few weeks had been intense, especially for first-timers like herself. It was like some kind of super high school, with cliques, factions, and social circles that formed as quickly as they dissipated. Hormones seemed to color the very air they breathed. Hookups happened, sometimes with remarkable speed, and breakups were found out almost at the same time as they occurred. After staff and hospitality training, many of the employees went en masse to bars and saloons in Encampment, Riverside, and Saratoga. They played as hard as they worked, and no one got enough sleep. Several new employees got into trouble when they crashed ATVs or were thrown off horses. A month into the season, though, it had smoothed out. Sheridan found herself too physically tired each night after turning out the horses to do much of anything else. Each day was a new adventure, and the first couple of months on the ranch had gone by in a blur. Of the 130 employees at the resort, the wranglers were considered elite because horseback riding was the most popular activity. Sheridan had applied for the wrangler position as a lark and was as shocked as her family that she'd gotten the job. She was even more surprised when she learned that there had been 300 applicants for the 10 open slots, and that she was the only Wyoming-born wrangler of the entire crew, which gave her a kind of special status among the other employees. Her boots, hat, and cruel girl western clothing had all come via her sister April's employment at Welton's Western Wear and Saddle String, so she looked the part. Wranglers from other states consulted her for fashion advice, and even male employees looked to her for what was authentic and what wasn't. That she'd been chosen to be offered a full-time position on the ranch, meaning her own apartment overlooking the indoor arena on one side and the Sierra Madre range from the other, was a point of pride. She also secretly liked the fact that she knew her mother envied her. And then there was Lance Ramsey, the boss of the equestrian division. Lance was 26, single, tall, laconic, gentlemanly, and the most knowledgeable and experienced horseman she'd ever met. Nothing riled him, and both the wranglers and the guests admired and respected him. He was from Montana, which was practically Wyoming, and he had a way about him that relaxed even the most hyper-intensive Type A guest. Lance's name was atop the guest surveys nearly every week as the most personable and professional wrangler they'd met during their stay. One of the most charming things about Lance, she thought, was that he seemed to have no idea that nearly every female guest had a crush on him. If anyone mentioned that fact, he'd blush and kick at the dirt with the point of his boot. Lance had asked Sheridan to stay for the winter season over the other wranglers, even those who were more experienced. That meant a lot to her. Sheridan finished opening the last of the waterholes by mid-morning. As she walked back to the ranch pickup and 21 horses, most of them sorrels, rushed past her to get to the water, she caught a glint of light on the southern horizon. The ranch itself was vast, and the skeleton staff of 28 people who worked there during the winter, primarily department heads and maintenance crew, kept pretty good tabs on one another. So it was unusual to see a vehicle that wasn't from the ranch parked high on the summit of the foothills to the south. Hunting season was over, she knew, and if there were any outside contractors on the place, she should have been briefed. The ranch fleet consisted primarily of white pickups emblazoned with the Silver Creek Ranch logo on the front doors like the truck she was driving. This truck was darker. She tossed the tools back into the bed of the pickup and didn't stop to look directly at the trespassers. She'd learned from growing up riding along with her father that it was best to proceed with normal activities when being spied upon, so as not to alert the spy. In her dad's case, he was usually being watched by hunters who might be in the wrong hunting area or who were poaching. Sheridan opened the rear door of the pickup and found a set of binoculars in the seat back. She removed the caps from the lenses and raised the glasses inside the cab so she could see clearly through the rear passenger window. The pickup on the horizon was gray and had a camper shell on the back. There was writing on the front door, but it was too distant for her to make out what it said. She took in a quick breath when she focused on the cab itself, because she could clearly see a pair of orbs side by side through the driver's side window, but not the driver himself. The orbs turned out to be the lenses of binoculars looking directly back at her. There was someone else in the cab, but she couldn't see who it was due to the sun's reflection on the windshield. Cell signal strength varied depending on where she was on the property, but she was relieved to see she had one bar on her phone. The call went straight through to her boss. He was out of breath when he answered. She assumed he was on the back of a horse in the arena. She said, "Lance, I'm down at the S-curve of the river, and I see a truck over on the hills to the south. Two people, it looks like. Are you aware of any contractors on the place today?" "Nobody told me about anyone working out there. Can you see a license plate?" "No, the truck's in profile, and whoever's driving it is looking back at me with binoculars."
"How long's he been there?"
"No idea, but I know it isn't one of ours."
"Stay put," he said. "I'll get there as soon as I can."
It was almost as if the trespassers were listening in, because the truck moved forward and slipped out of view on the other side of the hill.
"They're gone."
"I'm still on my way."
Lance had been particularly anxious and jumpy of late, she thought. Coming to check on her seemed like an overreaction.
"Well, okay. But before you come, I need to ask you to clear out your things from my apartment, just for the time being, you know, your toothbrush and razor. You've also got some clothes in the closet."
There was a long pause, then a pained, "Why, Sheridan?"
"I've got a situation. My dad is driving down here tomorrow. He's going to be staying in town, but he might just show up here first. If he does..."
She heard him gasp, then recover.
"Okay," he said. "I understand, I think."
"Thank you, Lance."
"Don't go chasing those trespassers until I get there, okay?"
"Okay.
I don't think I'd try to drive the truck across the ice, you know."
"Good. Now stay put and I'll get there as soon as I can. Get a license plate on that truck if you see it again."
"Right, boss," she said with a smile.
Chapter 7 Later that afternoon, Wiley Fry kicked off a pair of Crocs and shed a heavy blanket as he neared the thick cloud of steam that was the Mineral Hot Springs pool. He reached out through the steam to grasp the metal railing and muttered a curse before descending the moss-slick steps into the water itself. Damn, it was cold outside. The sensation, as always, was intense, below zero air on the bare skin of his back and shoulders and burning hot water below the surface. Both stung, but in different ways. He eased into the pool, felt the gravel surface beneath his feet, until he located the corner closest to the flow intake. He liked to think of this spot as Wiley's corner. It was close enough to the source of the geothermal spring called the Lobster Pot to be extremely hot, but far enough away that his delicate skin wouldn't blister.
He sat down slowly until the hot mineral water rose and washed over his shoulders. Only his head wasn't submerged. It was so cold outside and so hot inside the pool that clouds of thick steam rose from the top of the water, and he couldn't see a damn thing around him. Within a minute, as the 119-degree water stung his skin and the heat began to penetrate into his fat, sinews, and muscles, he took a deep breath of the sulfur-tinted air and closed his eyes. Wisps of steam rose through his scalp into the air like a chimney. The mineral water dissolved the powdered gypsum dust on his skin from hanging drywall all day in his new and improved shop. Gypsum rose to the surface in a slick before it floated away and dissipated. He had 2 hours. That was enough time to get in a hot soak, eat a big dinner at the Bear Trap or Duke's Bar and Grill, and show up for the night shift at the mill. Because of the extra money he was making, his ex-wife had stopped texting him for child support money, and his shop was insulated and almost completely drywalled. He could envision spending a lot of time out there with a wood stove blazing and ESPN or rodeo playing on a widescreen television. Life was good for Wiley. He wished, though, that he could get that acrid odor of burning hair and roast chicken out of his nose from before. It stayed with him in a way that he found disconcerting. He tried not to think about it, but it came back to him at odd times, and it was accompanied by a sharp pang of guilt. The owner of the mill was a good man who'd taken a chance on him and seemed to trust him. But it was more than that. Wiley hated guilt. He'd had more than enough of it when his marriage broke up. He blamed his mother because she was a devoted Catholic, and she'd made him go to church with his sister as a young boy. Many of his friends and co-workers seemed to have no inkling of the concept of guilt, and he envied them. With his eyes closed, Wiley found that his hearing sharpened up. He could hear the lap of the river just outside the wall of the hot springs pool, as well as contented clucking from wild ducks on the water. Every once in a while there was an errant shout from a guest who'd ventured outside from the Saratoga Hot Springs Resort across the river. The outtake grate at the other end of the pool sometimes made a slurping sound as hot water flowed through it. There were rarely any other people in the hot pool at this time of night, he'd found, even though it was free and open to the public 24 hours a day. Locals sometimes brought their young kids earlier in the evening to tire them out in the super-hot water, and drinkers came later at night after they'd done their rounds at the bars. During the day, it was travelers and oldsters. Wiley avoided seeing all that wrinkled old flesh the best he could. He'd had enough of that to last him a lifetime when he'd visited his mother 2 years ago at her retirement village in Arizona. That's why he chose to stay here through the winter. Wiley had found that 20 minutes in the hot pool was just enough. 20 minutes heated up the core of his body so he'd stay warm for nearly an hour before he got to the mill shack. His bulbous, milk-white body would turn crab-red by the time he left. In fact, he would sometimes break into a sweat as he walked from the pool toward his truck when it was 5 below. Often he carried his blanket instead of wearing it. Wiley had a big gut, and that belly fat heated up like an inner tube filled with hot water, and it kept him warm. He often wondered how skinny people ever survived the winter. Sometimes, when he felt adventurous, Wiley would lumber out of the hot springs, climb over the wall, and plunge into the North Platte River. There were several hot plumes of geothermal water out there as well, and sitting on a gout of hot water while the icy river flowed around him was a unique experience in itself. Wiley was so comfortable alone in the hot pool with his eyes closed that he nearly fell asleep. But he was startled when he heard a particular voice, guttural and flat, that he recognized as the one he'd heard on the other end of his cell phone. He couldn't see them through the steam, but he could hear and track them. The two men were talking low as they exited from the changing room and approached the hot pool. They were above and behind him, and Wiley knew that even if the steam cleared, the men wouldn't be able to see him in there because of the sight lines.
"Jesus, how hot is it?"
the guttural voice said.
"It's 125 at the source. That's what they say, anyway."
"That's too damn hot. Even in this cold, it's too damned hot."
The guttural man chuckled. Even his laugh was grating, Wiley thought.
"Well, do you swim in it, or what?"
"Nah, it's too shallow for that. You just sit in it like it's a bathtub. They say the Indians used to use it, but I don't know how true that is. They also say people with breathing problems used to come from hundreds of miles away to sit in it. I call bullshit on that."
There was silence for a moment, then a splash of water from the other side of the pool.
"God damn! Told you,"
the guttural man said. Wiley felt small wavelets lick his chin and jawbone as the two men entered the pool and sat down in the water.
"It stings like hell."
"You can get out any time. I'll meet you in the truck."
"You have the keys,"
the other man moaned. The guttural man laughed again.
"It's getting better now, sort of."
The guttural man laughed again.
"Yeah."
"How often do you come here?"
"Not often. I'm too busy most of the time. But when I do come, it's like 3 or 4 in the morning. I like to have it all to myself, like now."
Wiley remained still. They thought they were alone. He wanted to keep it that way. He hoped he wouldn't have a moment of flatulence, which sometimes happened when his guts got too hot. There were a couple of minutes of silence. He could hear the ducks in the river again. They didn't quack so much as titter, as if engaging in pillow talk.
"It's a hell of a thing," the other man said. "I was kind of blown away by what you showed me today. Man, the scale of it."
"It's mind-blowing. The amount of money that's gone into it is fucking crazy."
Wiley waited for more.
"What thing?"
The two men changed the subject to talk about the waitress who'd served them that night at the Saratoga Resort across the river. The other man thought she might have been flirting with him. He went on to recount the signals he thought he'd received from her.
"In your dreams,"
the guttural man growled.
"You'll see."
"Forget that and get some sleep while you're here. We've got a long day ahead of us tomorrow. We've got a lot of work to do before the boss arrives. Everything needs to be cleaned up like I told you. I don't want him asking any questions."
"Yeah."
"And I need to call that fucking rube to set up another delivery. Remind me to call him when we leave here."
"So it's back to the teepee, or whatever you call it."
"Wigwam burner, not teepee, wigwam."
"Wigwam," the other man repeated. "I knew it was some kind of Indian shit." And Wiley realized that the fucking rube was him. His belly shuddered with a growl, but no bad bubbles appeared. Wiley waited for another 15 minutes. He'd been in the pool much too long and was feeling faint. But he didn't dare move or speak before the two men left. Chances were the guttural man would recognize him. The two men continued to talk, but the subjects were football, gambling, and women they'd met embedded in different parts of the country.
"I keep thinking about that one I told you about,"
the guttural man said.
"The blonde one?"
"Yeah."
"Didn't you say she talked too much?"
"Find me one that doesn't."
"She's nothing compared to my little hottie waitress."
"Fuck you. You never saw her."
"True."
"So shut up about her."
There was a long pause.
"I didn't mean to hit a nerve. I was just fucking around, you know."
"Don't fuck around."
"Believe me, I've got it."
"Good."
Finally, the other man sighed and said, "I'm getting out."
"Yeah."
"I feel like I've been fucking boiled alive."
"You have."
He sat still until he heard a car start up in the parking lot. Then Wiley crawled out of the water with the grace of a walrus. Although he knew the concrete walkway was freezing, it felt good against his skin. He hoped his wet body wouldn't stick to it when he was ready to get up. At last he raised himself to his hands and knees. The time he'd spent in the hot pool had taken away most of his strength. Plus, he'd jammed himself up for time, and he'd have to grab a pizza or a hot dog at the come-and-go instead of enjoying a sit-down dinner. He'd also get a six-pack of Gatorade to replenish all the sweat he'd lost in the hot pool. When he shuffled to his truck, he checked his phone. No messages yet. But he was sure now he'd get another call later that night. The pang of guilt, like an icicle, stabbed at him just below the heart. Part 2. There is nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things. Niccolò Machiavelli. Chapter 8. Joe began the 300-mile drive from Saddle String to Saratoga as the morning sun winked over the Bighorn Mountains. He'd packed his gear into his pickup the night before so he could get an early start. After kissing Marybeth and Lucy goodbye at the breakfast table and unplugging the engine block heater outside in the parking lot, he paused at the door when Daisy padded along behind him. Tube stayed in bed. "I'll see you a little later," he said to Daisy as he stroked her head, hoping that in her Labrador brain she wouldn't realize that he meant days or weeks. He didn't think he'd fooled her, though. He'd left a complete copy of the Kate file for Marybeth to read, and the original was clamped under his arm. It was 19 below zero. The springs and steering of the truck were stiff at first in the morning cold, and it took nearly 20 minutes for the rock-hard frozen tires to become pliable. The streets of Saddle String were snow-packed and slick. Residents had gone outside to start their vehicles and had left them in their driveways to warm up, creating rising columns of white exhaust. The sun cleared the summit of the mountains and soon flooded the valley with cold light. The landscape was white and smooth for as far as he could see, with the exception of skeletal trees near the river and natural hedgerows of maroon buckbrush that caught the sunlight and held on tight. Angus cattle in the pastures had gathered into scrums to keep warm, and their exhalation condensed into miniature clouds. Although he'd slept well, he had arisen with his mind racing with what he'd learned about Kate's disappearance. There were plenty of gaps to fill, and they could only be filled on the ground by talking with people. He was intrigued to find out what Sheridan knew about Kate, since she'd ridden horses with her. Joe knew that, like fishing with someone, riding with a partner was often an intimate experience. There was time to talk while horses were saddled and tacked up, in the cab of the truck while they were being transported by trailer, and certainly over the hours on the trail. Sheridan was a good listener and always had been, and wranglers were like bartenders. People felt drawn to talk to them. Three aspects of the assignment bothered him, though. The first was the odd way Michael Williams had responded when Joe asked him about his work on the case. There was something Williams couldn't or wouldn't talk about, and Joe didn't know what it was. Williams and the DCI's investigation appeared methodical and solid. There was a real question about why they'd been taken off the case by Governor Allen, and Joe had trouble believing it had to do with budget cuts and bureaucratic inertia, as Allen had said. That led to the second concern in Joe's mind. Why him? Sure, Alan had found the old Rulon files where Joe had acted as the former governor's range rider. But with the entire DCI at his disposal, as well as local law enforcement on the scene, why had the governor chosen him? Something didn't make sense about it. Alan had no special feelings toward Joe. In fact, he seemed to distrust him, as Joe so far distrusted the governor in return. The third unknown, and one that hadn't really been discussed, addressed, or documented, had to do with Saratoga game warden Steve Pollock. Pollock would have been the natural person for the governor to ask to help him surreptitiously. After all, Pollock was on the ground and knew the area, the people, and presumably the situation with Kate's disappearance. But he was gone, and no one seemed to really know what had happened to him. There had been no interagency gossip about Pollock's situation. When a game warden quit or was fired, it was usually a big deal within the agency. Game warden positions were hard to get, and there were hundreds of applicants for every opening. Not only that, but an open district meant that all the current game wardens had the opportunity to apply for it. Seniority was the major consideration to getting a choice district. New game wardens received districts no one else wanted. Each game warden had a badge number whose order was based on how long they'd been employed relative to the others. Pollock had been badge number 18. Joe was now badge number 20, meaning there were 19 wardens his senior and 30 his junior. Saratoga, like Saddlestring, was considered to be one of the best districts in the state. It had mountains on three sides, the North Platte River, which was a blue ribbon trout fishery, and large concentrations of big game animals. It was kind of a resort area like Jackson Hole, but without the high-priced housing and amenities and the crush of tourists. It was an attractive place to live. Joe had once suggested that he and Mary Beth should apply for the district if it ever came open, and his wife had liked the idea, provided it could happen after all three girls were done with school. Joe had seen no notices from headquarters about the open position yet, which was curious. It was something he wanted to learn more about. Despite that, Joe had no idea if Pollock's termination was related to the Kate case or simply coincidental. But something about it nagged him. He doubted he would get a straight answer if he called headquarters. His director, Linda Green Dempsey, was rumored to be on thin ice with the new governor, and she'd bunkered in with the hope that he'd forget she was alive. Therefore, she kept her head down and had ceased sending out directives that might call attention to her. She wasn't the right person to call and ask about what had happened to Steve Pollock, especially if he'd done something wrong. Director LGD wouldn't want any bad publicity concerning game wardens to be heard by the new governor or his staff. If that was the situation, Director LGD and her executive team would wait for the smoke to clear and quietly open the district for applications later. Joe slowed down north of KC on Interstate 25 because the wind had kicked up. Ground blizzards like waves of thick-bodied snakes rolled across the blacktop and obscured the black ice underneath. He kept a tight grip on the wheel with the exception of an imaginary toast to Wyoming icon Chris Ledoux as he drove by the singer's hometown. He had toasted Ledoux countless times with Nate Romanowski as they passed through, and he did it again. But when he was done, he concentrated on his driving. The grill of a massive red Peterbilt tractor trailer filled his rearview mirror and then roared around him in the passing lane. Joe glimpsed license plates from New Jersey. The bulk and momentum of the truck rocked his pickup and stirred up the ground blizzards. For a brief and terrifying moment, Joe could see only white through the windshield, and he could gauge his progress only by glimpses of highway markers that shot by on the side of the road. He eased off the accelerator and waited for the truck to get far enough ahead of him that the flurry of snow smoke would clear and he could see again. For a second, he considered going after the driver with his lights and siren on, because he had the authority to cite him for driving too fast for conditions. But the thought of a high-speed chase on ice dissuaded him. Eventually, the snow cleared and Joe could see the back of the red Peterbilt a quarter mile ahead of him. It kicked up snow like a powerboat kicked up a wake. Driving across Wyoming in the dead of winter was always an adventure. It was the reason so many people never left their small towns or they wintered in Arizona. Joe didn't mind the winter. In fact, he perversely enjoyed how mortal and small it made him feel at times. Tough winters evened things out because everyone was in the same boat, as long as that boat was a four-wheel drive. He'd explained his reasoning to Mary Beth once, and she'd simply shaken her head. Joe topped a long hill and looked out at the vast black and white ribbon of highway to the south to see that the Peterbilt that had roared past him, as well as another semi, were both lying on their sides in the borrow ditch ahead of him. They looked like two large animals that had decided to lie on their sides to rest for a while. He pumped his brakes going down the incline and pulled in behind the red Peterbilt. The wind buffeted his pickup, and the blowing snow stuck to the passenger window. Through the blizzard, he could see a fireplug-shaped man hopping about in a black T-shirt, clutching a cell phone. The man gesticulated wildly toward his truck. He apparently didn't have a coat. Joe left his truck running and pulled on his parka and climbed out. The wind nearly blew him across the highway on the ice, but he bent over to make himself a smaller target. The driver had a 5-day growth of beard and food stains on the front of his T-shirt. He chattered at Joe in an unfamiliar language, Russian or something Eastern European, and gestured toward his truck as if he couldn't believe what had happened. The driver of the first truck was outside as well. He had a heavy red beard, and he looked like he wanted a piece of the Eastern European. Joe motioned for the red-bearded man, who also spoke a language unfamiliar to Joe, to go back to his vehicle, and for the Eastern European to climb back inside his cab to get out of the weather while he called for the highway patrol. A trooper who said he was eating breakfast at the Invasion Bar and Grill in KC responded and said he was on his way. "Anybody hurt?" the trooper asked. "Doesn't look like it," Joe said. "Both the drivers are from somewhere else, and I can't communicate with them. It looks like they had some kind of altercation on the highway, and they slid around until the wind blew them over." "Damn Russians, I'd bet. There's more of them on the road all the time. They're a pain in my ass," the trooper said with disgust. "You'd think they know how to drive in the winter. Don't they have winter over there, too?"
"Yep."
"Where's the crash?" While Joe cleared a roadside mileage marker of snow so he could report the location of the crash, another call came through on his phone. He squinted against the driving snow and saw it was from an unknown number. He punched it up and shouted, "Joe Pickett!" "What? Are you standing outside?" The voice was familiar, but Joe couldn't place it.
"Yes, the wind is blowing."
"I can hear it. This is Michael Williams, but this isn't an official call." Joe turned his back to the wind.
"Give me a minute," he said. "I'm talking to the highway patrol, and I'll get right back to you."
"Don't take too long," Williams said, obviously annoyed. Joe pulled his door shut against the wind and punched up Michael Williams on his phone. He'd told the trooper he would stay at the crash location until he arrived from KC and took over. Every few minutes, the dark-haired Russian in the T-shirt poked his head up out of the window of his cab and looked around. He appeared to be shouting. The red-bearded Russian in the other truck shook his fist at the driver of the red Peterbilt every time he saw him. "Sorry about the delay," Joe said to Williams.
"That's okay, but I don't have long to talk to you. I'm calling from my personal cell phone, and no one at DCI knows I'm making this call. You have to promise me it'll stay that way."
Joe agreed.
"I know who you are," Williams said.
I've seen your name around, and I know you did some work for Governor Rulon. I'm guessing Allen has asked you to do the same thing for him?
Before Joe could respond, William said, No need to confirm that. It just seems like something he would do.
Joe didn't confirm it.
Whatever the circumstances, you've got a reputation for being a stand-up guy.
Thank you. Why did he take you guys off the case? Joe asked. It seemed to me from reading the file you were building a good foundation to go forward.
We were.
Then a long pause.
I will only tell you it had nothing to do with the KSL case.
Meaning the Kate Shelford-Longdon case.
Yeah.
What do you mean when you say you were taken off the case for other reasons?
Look, William said, I really can't get into why we were ordered off. I have two kids and another one on the way. I need this job and the bennies, especially medical insurance. You know how it is in the bureaucracy. If this call we're having ever got back to my agency or the governor, I'd be toast. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so, Joe said. But he didn't.
I'm sure you have some questions about the investigation itself, so ask away. I'd like to see this case get cleared up one way or another, and if you can do it, I have no problem with that at all. The loose ends still nag me at night.
What loose ends?
William said, Keep in mind, I only have a few minutes until my break is over, and I need to head back.
Joe nodded, even though Williams couldn't see him do it.
Okay, Joe said. There's plenty of good background in the report, but no conclusions or theories. Why's that?
You've got the redacted version, William said. My original report listed suspects for further questioning.
Who redacted? I'm not going there. Do you have another question?
Yep, Joe said while he dug his spiral notebook and a pen out of the console box. What were the names of the people you wanted to question further?
I've got them right here, William said. The thing is, the Silver Creek Ranch really vets their people. They run background checks on everyone, and they don't hire any sketchy types. You and I both know that just because someone doesn't have a record doesn't mean they're not capable of doing something wrong. But in this situation, it didn't make much sense to me that a ranch employee had anything to do with the disappearance. They're just too busy, and they all live with each other in housing right on the ranch. They've got a bunch of dormitory-like buildings there.
Hell, they're a hell of a lot nicer than the dorms I stayed in at college.
Anyway, if someone followed Kate when she drove away and did something to her, one of the other employees would have noticed that the guy was gone. At least that's the theory I was operating under. Plus, he said, there are 250 employees at that ranch in the high season. It seemed like a waste of time and manpower to question them all. That's not to say we might not have had to do it eventually, but at the time it seemed unlikely that an employee would be involved.
Gotcha, Joe said.
I mean, we had absolutely no leads to follow. Since the employees were clean, we thought, we looked at other people who might have been on the ranch while KSL was there, or other people who might have had it out for her. I was operating under the assumption that if someone grabbed her, it wasn't random. She was one of the few unattached guests that week, and she's attractive. The guy who grabbed her knew he'd have to get rid of the rental car she drove away in, so I operated under the theory that someone saw her there and made her a target. But I didn't think it was an employee.
Joe didn't ask the obvious question because Williams was on a roll. The DCI agent said, Have you ever been there?
Not yet, but I've been to a few dude ranches.
The Silver Creek Ranch is not another dude ranch, Williams said with a chuckle. It's a world of its own, and it's a very controlled environment. Think of it as a cruise ship instead of a ranch. You've got a couple hundred employees and 80 or 90 guests all staying together on the same property. People don't just come and go because the ranch is so big and it has so many activities going on that anything anybody might possibly want is right there.
I understand.
Joe declined to mention that Sheridan worked there.
He thought it might take them on a tangent that would eat up the little time William said he had left to talk. Williams continued. So what I started to zero in on were the few people who came to the ranch that week who were not employees or guests, people who might not be as clean.
Contractors, Joe said.
Bingo. I got a list from the front gate of all the people who checked in and out that week, then I ran background checks on them. It turns out I got some hits on a couple of the names. Do you have a way to write these down?
Yes.
Jack and Joshua Tubner, Williams said.
He was obviously reading from notes, and he spelled the names.
They own a private fish hatchery outside of Saratoga.
Joe was familiar with the facility.
Father and son. They supply most of the guest ranches in the state, and they operate into Colorado and Montana. Lots of private landowners use them to stock trout in their ponds, so they're the type of people who move through places like the Silver Creek Ranch with no one really noticing. Jack, the old man, has a couple of B&Es on a sheet and a DUI. Josh, his son, spent a year in Rawlins for stalking an old girlfriend.
Stalking, Joe repeated.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, but I never got a chance to talk to either one of them.
Who else? Joe asked.
Ben and Brady Youngberg, Williams said, and spelled their names as well. They're farriers from Laramie, brothers. They come to the Silver Creek Ranch every couple of days in the summer to take care of the horses. And we're talking, I don't know, hundreds of horses. There's a decent chance they saw Kate since she's a rider. Probably a better chance the Youngbergs saw her than the Tubners.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Well, from what I heard by asking around, the Youngberg brothers are the best farriers in the state. It's hard physical work, man. They spend the entire day bent over, putting shoes on and taking shoes off. But these two are hound dogs. They work hard all day and party hard at night, wherever they are. Both have been charged with A and B, assault and battery, for bar fights. Brady spent a year in Rawlins for stomping some guy. They're rough customers.
Joe agreed.
There's one more, Williams said, and then I really have to go.
Shoot.
The ex-husband. Name's Richard Cheatham. I guess he and KSL had a pretty bitter and public divorce over in England. I couldn't really tie Richard to the case because I didn't get a chance to pursue that angle. But maybe he hired someone to follow her and take her out between the ranch and Denver. It's far-fetched, but you can never rule out the ex-husband, you know?
Right, Joe said, recalling that he'd also written down the name on his legal pad.
Outside, the trooper Joe had talked to cruised slowly by the pickup and pulled in behind the red Peterbilt.
Joe waved at him, and the highway patrolman waved back.
I really appreciate you calling me, Joe said to Williams. Yeah, well,
I'm not kidding.
And I'm not kidding about you keeping this between us, Williams said. But I would like to know what you find out.
I'll keep you posted, Joe agreed.
I don't like the idea of someone grabbing women tourists in this state, he said. I've got daughters, you know.
Me too, Joe said.
So I hope you find the bastard and put him away, even if the governor figures out a way to take credit for it.
Joe didn't comment, but before Williams punched off, Joe said, Hey, there's one more thing I want to ask you.
Do it fast.
There was a game warden down in Saratoga named Steve Pollock. Did you ever run into him? At first, Joe thought he'd lost the connection. Finally, William said,
Yeah, I met him a couple of times.
Do you have any idea what happened to him?
I'm not going there, William said with caution.
So him leaving might be connected to the case?
I'm not saying that at all. He might be connected to why we were taken off, but not to this.
Williams stopped speaking, and Joe strained to listen.
Let's just leave it here, the DCI agent said. I've already said too much. Gotta go.
And this time the connection went dead. Joe sat back and watched as the trooper emerged from his cruiser in a heavy parka. He waved his arms at both drivers to indicate they should stay in their vehicles. The two Eastern Europeans gesticulated wildly and pointed at each other, each attempting to pin the blame for the accident on the other one. The trooper shook his head, uninterested in the dispute. Even though Williams had ruled out the likelihood that the disappearance of Kate was a random act, Joe looked at the drivers and wrote down the words, "random stranger," next to the other suspects. It was a lonely highway from Saratoga toward Denver, after all. A tractor-trailer driver with no ties at all to the state or region could have happened on Kate driving alone. The trailers of the rigs on their sides in front of him were certainly large enough to hide Kate's Jeep if they were empty or half full. He knew the possibility was a long shot, but so was everything else. He also knew that if a random predator had taken her, he'd likely never find him. Joe nodded at the trooper as he eased his pickup back onto the icy highway. The highway patrolman didn't look to be in a very good mood. His last glimpse of the first Russian driver, with his wild eyes, stained T-shirt, and blowing snow now stuck to the side of his face, made Joe think, that guy is capable of anything. Once he turned off the interstate highway in Casper, Joe had a choice of traveling south on State Highway 487 over the Shirley Basin to Medicine Bow, or on Highway 220 through Alcova, Muddy Gap, and Rollins. Either route would lead to Saratoga, and both were two-lane roads. He paused and checked his phone for the road conditions on the YDOT website. Both routes were listed as wet, slick in spots with dangerous winds and blowing snow, advise no light trailers, extreme blowover risk. Six of one, half a dozen of the other, both perilous. He chose 487, and within an hour he was high on the Shirley Mountains plateau, where it seemed he was the only driver on the road, and he got the feeling, like he always did when he was there, that he'd ventured on top of the world, where the only inhabitants were pure white jackrabbits, pronghorn antelope, and the ghosts of winter drivers who'd slid off the highway. The plateau was stark, and there were no trees to cut the wind. Waves of blowing snow were forming small drifts across the road. He noted that the blades of the wind turbines that had been recently built on the flat were still. Joe knew that happened only in two conditions: when there was no wind at all, or when the winds were so high that the speed of the turning blades would damage the equipment. He recalled Chief of Staff Hanlon mentioning a massive new wind farm that was being built north of Saratoga, and that the governor had a keen interest in the project. Joe ate a late lunch in the historic Virginian Hotel in Medicine Bow, the town where the classic Western novel had been set. He was the only customer in the restaurant, and he went with the special, hot hamburger steak with mashed potatoes and brown gravy. He left a $20 tip because the geriatric waitress called him son, and she reminded him of a great aunt he had once liked. Plus, he hoped the extra money would incentivize her to stay around on days when there were so few customers. She thanked him for the tip while she rang him up. She said, "It's because of a game warden that my husband went to prison." Before Joe could react, she winked and said, "It was the best day of my life." Outside, he circled his pickup in the lot before climbing back in. Snow and ice were packed in the wheel wells from the drive and had built up until the mass was less than an inch from rubbing against the tread on the tires. He turned with his back to the truck and kicked at the ice with his boot heel until it broke away and fell to the gravel in blocky chunks. The wind finally died away mid-afternoon, as Joe crossed I-80 at Walcott Junction and drove south on YO-130 toward the town of Saratoga. The area had gotten plenty of snow, but it was hard to judge the depth because of the drifts. Icy waves of it shone in the sun, and it was so deep in places that only the top wire and tips of the fence posts were visible. Someone had used an earth mover to push the snow into barricades along the roadside hilltops to slow loose snow from drifting across the asphalt. Elk Mountain and the Snowy Range rose sun-kissed and blue, and the mountains dominated the view from the driver's side window. The Sierra Madre Range rose in front of him as well as out the passenger side. He noted that the upper north Platte River Valley, where Saratoga was located, was deceptively situated. The occupants of hundreds of thousands of cars and trucks using east-to-west I-80, where the terrain was high and windswept desert, would have no inkling that 21 miles to the south was a lush river valley with mountain peaks on three sides. A herd of 90 elk were bedded down and sunning themselves on the top of a ridge to the east. Their forms blended in so well with the snow and sagebrush cover that he would have missed them if it weren't for the glint of afternoon sun on the antlers of the bulls. He slowed down to let two bald eagles rise up clumsily from a road-killed rabbit in the middle of the highway. There were snow-packed dirt roads on either side of the highway leading either to distant ranches or river access on the North Platte, and not a single oncoming car. Saratoga, population 1,671 souls, and elevation 6,785 feet, appeared spread out in front of him after he topped a long rise. The town was choked with cottonwoods, and he could see a wide ribbon of river through the middle of it. The air shimmered over the hot stack of a lumber mill on the western edge of the town. Joe took a deep breath and slowly expelled it. The drive across the state on winter roads had been long and tense. As he crossed the bridge into town, he smelled wood smoke from the mill, and he saw hundreds of ducks and geese on the open water of the river. He loosened his tight grip on the wheel and let his shoulders relax. Saratoga to Joe was a smaller and more intimate version of Saddle String. He turned right on West Farm Avenue and cruised up a snow-covered street. There were modest single-family homes on the left and a large pasture on the right. Within two blocks, he found a brown two-story house with a sign in the front yard that read, Game Warden Station. There were no tire tracks on the driveway or on the two-track path that led to a metal storage shop. Joe pulled his pickup into the driveway and got out. The snow was ankle-deep on the way to the front door, and he stepped over four editions of the weekly Saratoga Sun that were frozen to the concrete on the front porch. So it had been a month since someone had retrieved them, he thought. Next to the doorbell was a handcrafted sign listing Steve Pollock's official hours, as well as telephone numbers for when he was off duty. The 800 Stop Poaching hotline was included as well. Joe had created a similar sign for the front of his house before it was torched. It didn't do much good. When citizens wanted to talk to the local game warden or report a violation, they didn't pay much attention to official hours of operation. That was part of the job. Although the house looked dark and empty, Joe rang the doorbell anyway. He could hear the chime echoing through the empty rooms inside. Then he knocked on the front door with the same result. Finally, he tried the knob. Locked. As he stepped off the porch, he could see a woman watching him through the side window of the next house. He waved, and she waved back, then stepped aside and closed the curtains. Circling the house in the snow, Joe glanced through the windows. There were what looked like empty boxes in the front room, as well as stray papers on the floor. He could see dirty dishes in the sink in the kitchen. Pollock's green Ford pickup, which was much cleaner than Joe's, was locked up in the garage. It looked like Steve Pollock had cleared out fast and no one had been there to clean up since he left. Joe shook his head as he trudged back to his pickup. He wondered if anyone in town had keys to the place, or if he'd need to request a set to get in. He placed a call to Casey Scales in Laramie, who was the Game and Fish Department district supervisor for the Snowy Range District. Scales had 5 game wardens under him in southeast Wyoming. Joe had met him a couple of times, and he seemed laid back. "Casey," Joe said, "I'm in Saratoga on a project, and I was wondering if I could get the keys from you to our house over here."
"Steve Pollock's old place?"
"Yep."
"I haven't been over there. What kind of shape did he leave it in?"
"Looks like he just walked right out the door," Joe said.
"Hmm.
Can you tell me what happened?" Joe asked.
"I would if I could, Joe, but your guess is as good as mine. You know I keep a loose rein on my guys, and I really don't get in their business unless I have to, or LGD leans on me."
"Right."
"Steve didn't give me any warning at all about anything," Scales said. "He did his job as far as I can tell, and he turned in his monthly reports on time. He had a lot of autonomy, and he never gave me any reason not to trust him, so I just let him do his thing. He never told me he was dissatisfied with anything or gave me any reason to think he was going anywhere, and I haven't heard any evidence that somebody chased him off. When I heard he left, I called his ex-wife Lindy, and it was real awkward because she didn't know he quit. I was the one breaking the news to her."
"Did she give you any reason why he might have left?" Joe asked.
"Well, she thought he might have taken up with a woman. There's some real fancy ones that come through Saratoga, you know. But she was just guessing, really. Steve had never mentioned another woman to her."
"Maybe the job just got overwhelming," Joe speculated. He made a mental note to himself to add Pollock's name to his list of suspects.
"Maybe," Scales said. "There's a lot going on around there, and that's not counting all the new directives LGD and Governor Allen are pumping out. But I can't imagine Steve not just rolling with it. He's like me. He isn't a guy to get all worked up about things."
"About those keys," Joe said.
"Shouldn't be a problem at all," Scales said. "I think we've got an extra set at the office. I'll run them down and maybe even drive them over to you tomorrow if the roads are open."
"Thank you."
"What kind of project do they have you doing all the way down here?" Scales asked.
"Oh, you know," Joe hedged.
"Just more bullshit," Scales chuckled. "Kind of what they've got me doing. Let me know if you need anything or any info on the district. I might be able to help."
Joe breathed a sigh of relief that Casey Scales hadn't pressed him more, and he knew he wouldn't be occupying the game warden house that night. Joe thumbed through the case file and found the name and number of Carbon County Sheriff Ron Neal. Neal's headquarters was in Rawlins, which was 42 miles away via Fort Steele and Sinclair. Carbon County was nearly 8,000 square miles and included most of the Red Desert, where Joe had been involved in a terrifying incident 2 years before. It took a while to get through directly to the sheriff himself, but finally there was a brusque, "Sheriff Neal." Joe told him he was making a courtesy call to let Neal know he was in the county working on the missing persons case on behalf of the governor. Neal was silent for a moment. "Does the governor think we can't do our job here?"
"Well, it's not that," Joe said. "He just wants another set of eyes on it, I guess." "You're the fellow who was involved in that big mess out in the Red Desert, right?"
"Right."
"I was kind of hoping we wouldn't see you again."
"I understand," Joe said.
"Why'd he pull the DCI off the investigation?" Neal asked.
"I can't speak for the governor.
He should have let them do their job, just like he should let me do mine."
Joe took a deep breath and said, "Sheriff Neal, I really don't want to get crosswise with you. This wasn't my call."
"I appreciate that," Neal said after a beat.
Seems odd they'd send a game warden, though. Are you taking over for Pollock?
Temporarily.
That was an odd circumstance, Neil said. Any idea why he just up and left?
No, I'd like to find out myself.
If you do, please let me know, Neil said. I like that guy, and I thought he was on the level. And keep me posted on what you find out about that English gal.
I'll do that, Joe said.
Let me know if there's anything I can do to help. I don't like the idea of a woman vanishing in my county.
Thank you.
And try to keep a lower profile than you did the last time you were here, for Christ's sake, Neil said with a chuckle.
I'll do that too, Joe assured him.
He drove back downtown and turned onto Main and slid into a diagonal space in front of the Hotel Wolf. The building was a three-story Victorian structure constructed of red brick, with a covered front porch and lonely chairs and benches. The windows to the bar on the right side glowed warm yellow. He knew that the hotel rented rooms, although he hadn't made a reservation. He didn't figure it would be necessary in January, and judging by the few cars parked along the small downtown, he'd made the right guess. As he reached down to open his door, the front door of the Wolf opened and three cowboys came out. Two wore wide-brimmed hats, Carhartt parkas, and Sorel pack boots. The third man, who looked older,